as a correction in the general market starts to develop. This should get you into a questioning, defensive frame of mind sooner. Following this one simple but powerful rule of ours saved a lot of people big money in 2000's devastating decline in technology leaders. Right after the first selling near the top, a vacuum exists where volume may subside and the market averages will sell off for 4 days or so. The second, and probably last early chance to recognize a top reversal, is when the market attempts its first rally. This usually comes several days down from the peak. Most stock market technicians are fooled by the initial market decline off the top if they see volume contracting. They don't understand that this is a normal occurrence after heavy volume distribution has occurred on the way up around the top. Volume begins to pick up on the downside days or weeks later, when the weakness becomes obvious to more investors. As in anything else, if you wait until the writing's on the wall, it's going to cost you more. You'll be selling late. Following several days of increased volume distribution around the top and the first decline resulting from it, there will be either a poor rally in the market averages followed by a rally failure, or a positive and powerful follow-through on price and volume. You should learn in detail exactly what signals to look for and remain unbiased about the market. Let the day-by-day market averages tell you what the market has been doing and is doing. After the market does top out, it typically will rally feebly and then fail. For instance, after the first day's rebound, the second day will open strongly, but toward the end of the session, the market will suddenly close down. The abrupt failure of the market to follow through on its first recovery attempt should probably be met by further selling on your part. You'll know the initial bounce back is feeble if, 1, the index advances in price on the 3rd, 4th, or 5th rally day, but on volume lower than the day before. 2, the average makes little net upward price progress compared with the progress the day before. Or 3, the market average recovers less than half of the initial drop from its former absolute intraday high. Further selling is advisable when you see these weak rallies and failures. How Can Slim and IBD red-flagged the March 2000 NASDAQ top? In October 1999, the market took off on a furious advance. Fears of a Y2K meltdown on January 1st had faded. Companies were announcing strong profits from the third quarter, which had just ended the month prior. Leading tech stocks, as well as speculative internet and biotechnology issues, racked up huge gains in just 5 months. But cracks started to appear in early March 2000. Many leaders suffered from classic climax tops. On March 7th, the NASDAQ closed lower on higher volume, the first instance in more than 6 weeks. That's unusual action during a roaring bull market, but 1 day of distribution isn't always significant on its own. Still, it was a yellow flag, worth carefully watching. 3 days later, the NASDAQ bolted more than 85 points to a new high in the morning, but reversed in the afternoon. It finished the day up only 2 points, as volume remained heavy. That churning action, a lot of trading action but no real progress, a clear sign of distribution, was all the more important because leading stocks started showing their own symptoms of hitting a climax top. Over the next week, many leaders broke down as the NASDAQ corrected 13%. The index managed to put together a suspect rally from March 16th to 24th, but it soon ran out of steam and rolled over in heavier volume, a final, definite confirmation of the March 10th top. During the next 2 weeks, the NASDAQ, as well as the S&P 500 and Dow, suffered repeated bouts of distribution as the indices sold off in heavier volume than the prior day. Astute, can-slim investors had all long since taken their profits. The second most important indicator of primary changes in market direction after the daily averages is the way leading stocks act. After the market has advanced for a couple of years, you can be fairly sure it's headed for trouble if most of the individual stock leaders start acting abnormally. One example of abnormal activity can be seen when leading stocks break out of third or fourth stage chart base formations on the way up. Most of these base structures will be faulty, with price fluctuations appearing much wider and looser. A faulty base, wide, loose, and erratic, can best be recognized and analyzed by studying charts of a stock's daily or weekly price and volume history. Another sign of abnormal activity is the climax top. Here, a leading stock will run up more rapidly for 2 or 3 weeks in a row after having advanced for many months. A few leaders will have their first abnormal price break off the top on heavy volume and then be unable to rally more than a small amount from the lows of their correction. Still others will show a serious loss of upward momentum in their most recent quarterly earnings reports. Shifts in market direction can also be detected by reviewing the last 4 or 5 stock purchases in your own portfolio. If you haven't made a dime on any of them, you could be picking up signs of a new downtrend. Investors who use charts and understand market action know that there are very few leading stocks that will be attractive around market tops. There simply aren't any stocks coming out of sound chart bases that can be bought. Most bases are wide, loose, and erratic, a giant sign of real danger you must learn to understand and obey. Also, the tendency is for laggard stocks to show strength at this stage. The sight of sluggish or low-priced, lower-quality laggards strengthening is a signal to the wise market operator that the upward market move may be near its end. Even turkeys can try to fly in a windstorm. During bear markets, certain leading stocks will seem to be bucking the trend by holding up in price, creating the impression of strength. But what you're seeing is just a postponement of the inevitable. When they raid the house, they usually get everyone, and eventually all the leaders will succumb to the selling. This is exactly what happened in the 2000 bear market. Cisco and other high-tech leaders all eventually collapsed, in spite of how many analysts incorrectly said they should be bought. Market tops, whether intermediate, usually 8% to 12% declines, or primary bull market peaks, sometimes occur 5, 6, or 7 months after the last major buy point in leading stocks and in the averages. Thus, top reversals are usually late signals, the last straw before a cave-in. In most cases, distribution or selling has been going on for days or even weeks in individual market leaders. Use of individual stock selling rules should have already led you to sell 1 or 2 of your holdings on the way up, just before the market peak. When the original market leaders begin to falter, you may see lower priced, lower quality, more speculative stocks begin to move up. Watch out. When the old dogs begin to bark, the market is on its last feeble leg. Among the telltale signs are the poor quality stocks that start to dominate the most active list on market up days. It's simply a matter of weak leadership trying to command the market. If the best ones can't lead, the worst certainly aren't going to for very long. Many top reversals, when the market closes at the bottom of its trading range after making a new high that day, have occurred from the 3rd to the 9th day of a rally after the averages moved into new high ground off small chart bases, meaning the time span from the start to the end of the pattern is short. It's important to note the conditions under which the tops occurred were all about the same. At other times, a topping market will recover for a couple of months and get back near or even above its old high before breaking down in earnest. This occurred in December 1976, January 1981, and January 1984. There's an important psychological reason for this. The majority of people in the market can't be exactly right at exactly the right time. In 1994, the NASDAQ didn't top until weeks after the Dow did. A similar thing happened in early 2000. The majority in the stock market will be fooled first. This includes both professional and individual investors. If you were smart enough to sell or sell short in January 1981, the powerful rebound in February and March probably forced you to cover your short sales at a loss or buy some stocks back during the strong rally. It was an example of how treacherous the market really is. I didn't have much problem recognizing and acting upon the early signs of the many bear markets from 1962 through 2000. But a couple of times, I made the mistake of buying back too early. When you make a mistake in the stock market, the only sound thing to do is correct it. Pride and ego never pay off. Neither does vacillation when losses start to show up. The typical bear market, and some aren't typical, usually has three separate phases, or legs, of decline, interrupted by a couple of rallies that last just long enough to convince investors to begin buying. In 1969 and 1974, a few of these phony, drawn-out rallies lasted up to 15 weeks. Most don't last that long. Many institutional investors love to bottom fish. They'll start buying stocks off a supposed bottom and help make the rally convincing enough to draw you in. You're better off staying on the sidelines in cash until a real new bull market starts. Once you've recognized a bear market and have scaled back your stock holdings, the big question is how long you should remain on the sidelines. If you plunge back in the market too soon, the apparent rally may fade and you'll lose money. But if you hesitate at the brink of the eventual roaring recovery, opportunities will pass you by. Again, the daily general market averages provide the best answer by far. At some point in every correction, whether mild or severe, the stock market will always attempt to rally. Don't jump back in right away. Wait for the market itself to confirm the new uptrend. A rally attempt begins when a major market average closes higher after a decline, either from earlier in the day or the previous session. For example, the Dow plummets 3% in the morning, but then recovers later in the day and closes higher. Or the Dow closes down 2% and then rebounds the next day. The session in which the Dow closes higher is the first day of the attempted rally. Sit tight and be patient. The first few days of improvement can't tell you if the rally will succeed. Starting on the fourth day of the attempted rally, look for one of the major averages to follow through, meaning it shows a booming 2% or more gain on heavier volume than the day before. This tells you the rally is much more likely to be real. The most powerful follow-throughs usually occur on the fourth to seventh days of the rally. Follow-throughs after the tenth day may indicate a positive but somewhat weaker new uptrend. A follow-through day should give the feeling of an explosive rally that is strong, decisive, and conclusive, not begrudging and on the fence, barely up 1%. The market's volume for the day should be above its average daily volume, in addition to always being higher than the prior day's trading. Occasionally, a follow-through occurs as early as the third day of the rally. In such a case, the first, second, and third days must all be very powerful, with a major average up 1% to 2% or more each session in heavy volume. I used to use 1% as the required percentage increase for a valid follow-through day. However, in recent years, as institutional investors learned of our system, we've moved up the requirement to 2% to minimize professionals manipulating a few stocks in the Dow averages to create false or faulty follow-through days. There will be a few cases in which confirmed rallies fail. A few large institutional investors, armed with their immense buying power, can run up the averages on a particular day and create the impression of a follow-through. Unless the smart buyers are back on board, the rally will implode, usually crashing in heavy volume within the next day or two. However, just because the market corrects the day after a follow-through, it doesn't mean the follow-through was false. When a bear market bottoms, it frequently pulls back and settles above or near the lows made during the previous few weeks. It is more constructive when these pullbacks or tests hold up at least a little above the absolute intraday lows made recently in the market averages. A follow-through signal doesn't mean you should rush out and buy with abandon. It gives the go-ahead to begin buying quality stocks as they break out of sound price bases, and it is a vital second confirmation that the attempted rally is succeeding. Remember, no new bull market has ever started without a strong price and volume follow-through confirmation. It pays to wait and listen to the market. The really big money is usually made in the first 1 or 2 years of a normal bull market cycle. It is at this point you must recognize and fully capitalize upon the golden opportunities presented. The rest of the up cycle usually consists of back-and-forth movement in the market averages, followed by a bear market. The year 1965 was one of the few exceptions, but that strong market in the third year of a new cycle was caused by the beginning of the Vietnam War. In the first or second year of a new bull market, you should have a few intermediate-term declines in the market averages. These usually last a couple of months, with the market indices dropping 8% to an occasional 15%. After several sharp downward adjustments of this nature, and once 2 years of a bull market have passed, heavy volume without further upside progress in the daily market averages could indicate the beginning of the next bear market. Since the market is governed by supply and demand, you can decipher a chart of the general market averages about the same way as you read the chart of an individual stock. The Dow Jones Industrial Average and S&P 500 are displayed prominently in the better publications. Investors Business Daily displays the NASDAQ Composite, Dow, and S&P 500 stacked on one page for easier comparison. These charts should show the high, low, and close of the market averages day by day for 6 to 12 months, together with the daily New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ volume in millions of shares traded. Normal bear markets show 3 legs of price movement down, but there's no rule saying you can't have 4 or even 5 down legs. You have to objectively evaluate overall conditions and events in the country and let the market averages tell their own story. And you have to understand what that story is. Additional ways to identify key market turning points. Look for divergence of key averages. Several averages should be checked at market turning points to see if there are significant divergences, meaning they are moving in different directions, one up and one down, or one is advancing or declining at a much greater rate from another. For example, if the Dow is up 100 and the S&P 500 is up only the equivalent of 20 on the Dow for the day, the S&P 500 being a broader index, it would indicate the rally is not as broad and strong as it appears. To compare the S&P 500 change to the Dow, divide the S&P 500 into the Dow average and then multiply by the change in the S&P 500. For example, if the Dow closed at 10,000 and the S&P 500 finished at 2,500, the 10,000 Dow would be 4 times the S&P 500 index. Therefore, if the Dow on a particular day is up 100 points and the S&P 500 is up 10, you can multiply the 10 by 4 and find that the S&P 500 was only up the equivalent of 40 points on the Dow. The Dow's new high in January 1984 was accompanied by a divergence in the indices. The broader-based, more significant S&P 500 did not hit a new high. This is the reason most professionals plot the key indices together, to make it easier to spot non-confirmations at key turning points. Institutional investors periodically run up the 30-stock Dow, while the broader NASDAQ is under liquidation. Certain psychological market indicators can help. Now that speculation in put and call options is the get-rich-quick scheme for many investors, you can plot and analyze the ratio of calls to puts for another valuable insight into crowd temperament. Options traders buy calls, which are options to buy common stock, or puts, which are options to sell common stock. A call buyer hopes prices will rise. A buyer of put options wishes prices to fall. If the volume of call options in a given period of time is greater than the volume of put options, one may logically assume that option speculators as a group are expecting higher prices and are bullish on the market. If the volume of put options is greater than that of calls, speculators hold a bearish attitude. When option players buy more puts than calls, the put-to-call ratio index increases above 1.0, which coincided with general market bottoms in 1990, 1996, 1998, and April and September 2001. The percentage of investment advisors who are bearish is an interesting measure of investors' sentiments. When bear markets are near the bottom, the great majority of advisory letters will usually be bearish. Near market tops, most will be bullish. The majority is usually wrong when it's most important to be right. However, you cannot blindly assume that because 65% of investment advisors were bearish the last time the general market hit bottom, a major market decline will be over the next time the investment advisors index reaches the same point. The short interest ratio is the amount of short selling on the New York Stock Exchange, expressed as a percentage of total New York Stock Exchange volume. This ratio can reflect the degree of bearishness shown by speculators in the market. Along bear market bottoms, you will usually see two or three major peaks, showing sharply increased short selling. There's no rule governing how high the index should go, but studying past market bottoms can give you an idea of what the ratio looked like at key market junctures. An index sometimes used to measure the degree of speculative activity is the NASDAQ volume as a percentage of New York Stock Exchange volume. This measure provided a helpful tip-off of impending trouble during the summer of 1983, when NASDAQ volume significantly increased relative to the big boards, New York Stock Exchange. When a trend persists and accelerates, indicating wild, rampant speculation, you're close to a general market correction. Interpret the overrated advanced decline line. Some technical analysts religiously follow advanced decline, AD, data. Technicians take the number of stocks advancing each day versus the number declining, and then plot that ratio on a graph. Advanced decline lines are far from precise, because they frequently prematurely veer down sharply, long before a bull market finally tops. In other words, the market keeps advancing toward higher ground, but is being led by fewer but better stocks. The advanced decline line is simply not as accurate as the key general market indexes, because analyzing the market's direction is not a total numbers game. All stocks are not created equal. It's better to know where the real leadership is and how it's acting than it is to know how many more mediocre stocks are advancing and declining. The New York Stock Exchange AD line peaked in April 1998. It trended lower during the new bull market that broke out 6 months later in October. The AD line continued to fall from October 1999 to March 2000, missing one of the market's most powerful rallies. An advanced decline line can sometimes be helpful when a clear-cut bear market attempts a short-term rally. If the AD line lags the market averages and can't rally, it's giving an internal indication that, despite the rally's strength in the Dow or S&P, the broader market remains frail. In such instances, the rally usually fizzles. In other words, it takes more than just a few leaders to make a new bull market. At best, the advanced decline line is a secondary indicator of limited value. If you hear commentators or TV market strategists extolling its virtues bullishly or bearishly, they probably haven't done their homework. Watch Federal Reserve Board rate changes. Among fundamental general market indicators, changes in the Federal Reserve Board's discount rate, the interest rate the Fed charges member banks for loans, the Fed funds rate, the interest rate that banks with fund reserves charge for loans to banks without fund reserves, and occasionally stock margin levels, are valuable indicators to watch. As a rule, interest rates provide the best confirmation of basic economic conditions, and changes in the discount rate and Fed funds rate are by far the most reliable. Three successive significant hikes in the discount rate have generally marked the beginning of bear markets and impending recessions. Bear markets have usually, but not always, ended when the rate was finally lowered. On the downside, the discount rate increased to 6% in September 1987, just after Alan Greenspan became chairman, led to the severe market break that October. Money market indicators mirror general economic activity. At times, I follow selected government and Federal Reserve Board measurements, including 10 indicators of the supply and demand for money and indicators of interest rate levels. History proves that the direction of the general market, as well as of several industry groups, is often affected by changes in interest rates, because the level of interest rates is usually tied to tight or easy Fed monetary policy. For the investor, the simplest and most relevant monetary indicators to follow and understand are the changes in the Federal Reserve Board discount rate and the Fed funds rate. With the advent of program trading and various hedging devices, some funds hedge portions of their portfolio in an attempt to provide some downside protection during risky markets. The degree to which these are successful again depends greatly on skill and timing, but one possible effect for some managers may be to lessen the pressure to dump portfolio securities on the market. The hourly market index and volume changes. At key turning points, an active market operator can watch market indices and volume changes hour by hour and compare them to volume in the same hour of the day before. A good time to watch hourly volume figures is during the first attempted rally following the initial decline off the market peak. You should be able to see if volume is dull or dries up on the rally. You can also see if the rally starts to fade late in the day, with volume picking up as it does, a sign that the rally is weak and will probably fail. Hourly volume data also come in handy when the market averages reach an important prior low point and start breaking that support area. A support area is a previous price level below which investors hope an index will no longer continue to fall. What you want to know is whether selling picks up dramatically or by just a small amount as the market collapses into new low ground. If selling picks up dramatically, this will represent significant downward pressure on the market. After the market has undercut previous lows for a few days, but on only slightly higher volume, look for 1 or 2 days of increased volume without the general market index going lower. If you see this, you may be in a shakeout area when the market pressures many traders to sell, often at a loss, ready for an upturn after scaring out weak holders. This occurred on April 23rd and 24th, 1990. Overbought, oversold. Two risky words. The short-term overbought, oversold indicator has an avid following among some individual technicians and investors. It's a 10-day moving average of advances and declines in the market. But be careful. At the start of a new bull market, the overbought, oversold index can become substantially overbought. This should not be taken as a sign to sell stocks. A big problem with indices that move counter to the trend is that you always have the question of how bad it can get before everything finally turns. Many amateurs follow and believe almost religiously in overbought, oversold indicators. Something similar can happen in the early stage or first leg of a major bear market, when the index becomes unusually oversold. This is really telling you that a bear market may be imminent. The market was oversold all the way down during the brutal market implosion of 2000. I once hired a well-respected professional who relied on such technical indicators during the 1969 market break, at the very point when everything told me the market was getting into serious trouble and I was aggressively trying to get several portfolio managers to liquidate stocks and raise large amounts of cash. He was telling them that it was too late to sell because his overbought, oversold indicator said the market was already very oversold. You guessed it, the market then split wide open. Needless to say, I rarely pay attention to overbought, oversold indicators. What you learn from years of experience is usually more important than the opinions and theories of experts using their many different favorite indicators. Other general market indicators. Upside-downside volume is a short-term index that relates trading volume in stocks that close up in price for the day to volume in stocks that close down. This index, plotted on a 10-day moving average, may show divergence at some intermediate turning points in the market. For example, after a 10% to 12% dip, the general market averages may continue to penetrate into new low ground for a week or two, yet the upside-downside volume may suddenly shift and show steadily increasing upside volume with downside volume easing. This switch usually signals an intermediate-term upturn in the market. Of course, you'll pick up the same signals if you watch the changes in the daily Dow, NASDAQ, or S&P 500, and market volume. Some services measure the percentage of new money flowing into corporate pension funds, that is, invested in common stocks, and the amount invested in cash equivalents or bonds. This opens another window to institutional investor psychology. However, majority or crowd thinking is seldom right, even when it's done by professionals. Every year or two, Wall Street seems to be of one mind, with everyone following each other like a herd of cattle. They either all pile in or all pile out. An index of defensive stocks, more stable and supposedly safer issues, such as utilities, tobaccos, foods, and soaps, may often show strength after a couple of years of bull market conditions. This may indicate smart money slipping into defensive positions and a weaker general market ahead. Also helpful in evaluating the stage of a market cycle is determining the percentage of stocks making new price highs in the defensive or laggard categories. In pre-1983 cycles, some technicians rationalized their lack of concern with market weakness by citing the number of stocks still making new highs. But analysis of new high lists shows that a large percentage of preferred or defensive stocks signal bear market conditions. Superficial knowledge can hurt you in the stock market. To summarize this complex but vitally important chapter, learn to interpret the daily price and volume changes of the general market indices and the action of individual market leaders. Once you know how to do this correctly, you can stop listening to all the costly and uninformed personal market opinions of amateurs and professionals alike. As you can see, the key to staying on top of the stock market is not predicting or knowing what the market is going to do, but knowing what the market has actually done recently and what it is currently doing. We don't want to give personal opinions and predictions. We carefully observe daily market supply and demand as it changes. One of the great values to this system of interpreting the market averages, price, and volume changes is not just the ability to recognize major market tops and bottoms, but also the ability to track each rally attempt when the market is on its way down. By waiting for powerful follow-through days, you can normally prevent yourself from being drawn into the market prematurely when rally attempts ultimately end in failure. In other words, you have rules that will continue to keep you out of a declining market so that you don't get sucked into phony rallies. This is how we were able to stay out of the market and in money market funds for most of 2000 and 2001, and preserve gains made in 1998 and 1999. There is a fortune for you in this paragraph. It isn't enough just to read. You need to remember and apply all of what you read. To help you remember, we've come up with the simple two-word acronym CAN-SLIM. Each letter in CAN-SLIM stands for one of the seven basic fundamentals of selecting outstanding stocks. Most successful stocks have these seven common characteristics at emerging growth stages, so they are worth committing to memory. Repeat this formula until you can recall it and use it easily. C equals current quarterly earnings per share. They must be up at least 18% or 20%, the higher the better. Also, quarterly sales should be accelerating or up 25%. A equals annual earnings increases. Require significant growth for each of the last 3 years and a return on equity of 17% or more. N equals new products, new management, new highs. Look for new products or services, new management, or significant new changes in industry conditions. And most important, buy stocks as they emerge from sound chart bases and begin to make new highs in price. S equals supply and demand, shares outstanding plus big volume demand. Any size capitalization is acceptable in today's new economy, as long as a company fits all other can-slim rules. Look for big volume increases when a stock begins to move out of its basing area. L equals leader or laggard. Buy market leaders and avoid laggards. Buy the number one company in its field. Most leaders' relative price strength rating will be 80 to 90 or higher. I equals institutional sponsorship. Buy stocks with increasing sponsorship and at least a few institutional sponsors with top-notch recent performance records. Also look for companies with management ownership. M equals market direction. Learn to determine overall market direction by accurately interpreting the daily market indices, price and volume movements, and the action of individual market leaders. This can determine whether you win big or lose. On Wall Street, wise men can be just as easily drawn into booby traps as fools. From what I've seen, in fact, the length and quality of one's education have very little to do with making big money investing in the market. The more intelligent people are, the more they think they know what they're doing, and the more they may have to learn the hard way how little they really know about outsmarting the stock market. The few people I've known over the years who've been unquestionably successful making money in stocks were decisive individuals without huge egos. The market has a simple way of whittling all excessive pride and overblown egos down to size. After all, the whole idea is to be completely objective and recognize what the marketplace is telling you, rather than try to prove what you said or did yesterday or 6 weeks ago was right. The fastest way to take a bath in the stock market is to try to prove that you are right and the market is wrong. Humility and common sense provide essential balance. Sometimes the more widely quoted and accepted the expert, the more trouble you can get yourself into. A well-known expert in the spring and summer of 1982 insisted that government borrowing was going to crowd out the private sector, and that interest rates and inflation would soar back to new highs. The exact opposite happened. Inflation broke, and interest rates came crashing down. Another expert's bear market call in the summer of 1996 backfired, as it came only one day from the market bottom. In the 2000 bear market, one expert after another kept saying week after week on CNBC that it was time to buy high-tech stocks, only to watch the techs continue to plummet further. Many high-profile analysts and strategists kept telling investors to capitalize on these once-in-a-lifetime buying opportunities on the way down. Buying on the way down can be a dangerous pastime. Conventional wisdom or consensus thinking is seldom right in the market. I never pay any attention to the parade of experts voicing their personal opinions on the market. It just creates entirely too much confusion and can cost you a great deal of money. Some strategists in 2000 were telling people to buy the dips, short-term declines in price, because the cash position of mutual funds had increased greatly, such that there was all this money sitting on the sidelines. All anyone had to do to prove this wrong was to look at the General Markets and Sectors page in Investor's Business Daily. It showed that while mutual fund cash positions had indeed risen, the move was still significantly under historical highs, and even under historical averages. The only thing that works is to let the market indices tell you the time to enter and exit. Never fight the market. It's bigger than you are. Chapter 8. 19 Common Mistakes Most Investors Make. Newt Rockne, the famous winning Notre Dame football coach, used to say, "Build up your weaknesses until they become your strong points." The reason people either lose money or achieve mediocre results in the stock market is they simply make too many mistakes. It's the same in your business, life, or career. You are held back or have reverses, not because of your strengths, but because of your mistakes or weaknesses that you do not recognize and correct. Most people just blame somebody else. It is much easier to have excuses and alibis than it is to realistically examine your own behavior. Since the early 1960s, I have known or dealt with countless individual risk-takers, from inexperienced beginners to smart professionals. What I've discovered is that it doesn't matter whether you're just getting started or have many years, even decades, of investing experience. In fact, experience is harmful if it continuously reinforces your bad habits. Success in the market is achieved by avoiding the classic mistakes made most often by the least successful investors. These are the mistakes you must avoid. 1. Stubbornly holding on to losses when they are very small and reasonable. Most could get out cheaply, but because people are human, emotions take over. You don't want to take a loss, so you wait and you hope, until your loss gets so large it costs you dearly. This is by far the number one mistake most investors make. They don't understand that all stocks are highly speculative and can involve huge risks. Without exception, you should cut every single loss short. My rule is to always cut all losses immediately when a stock falls 7% or 8% below my purchase price. Following this simple rule will ensure you will survive another day to invest and capitalize on future opportunities. 2. Buying on the way down in price, thus ensuring miserable results. A declining stock seems a real bargain because it's cheaper than it was a few months earlier. An acquaintance of mine bought International Harvester in March 1981 at $19 because it was down sharply. This was his first investment, and he made the classic tyro's mistake. He bought a stock near its low for the year. As it turned out, the company was in serious trouble and headed for possible bankruptcy. In late 1999, a young woman I know bought Xerox when it dropped abruptly to a new low at $34 and seemed really cheap. A year later, it traded at $6. Why try to catch a falling dagger? 3. Averaging down in price rather than up when buying. If you buy a stock at $40 and then buy more at $30 and average out your cost at $35, you are following up your losers and putting good money after bad. This amateur strategy can produce serious losses and weigh your portfolio down with a few big losers. 4. Buying large amounts of low-priced stocks rather than smaller amounts of higher-priced stocks. Many think it's smarter to buy more shares in round lots of 100 or 1,000 shares. This makes people feel like they're getting a lot more for their money. They'd be better off buying 30 or 50 shares of higher-priced, better-performing companies. Think in terms of dollars when you invest, not the number of shares you can buy. Buy the best merchandise available, not the cheapest. Many investors can't resist $2, $5, or $10 stocks. But most stocks selling for $10 or less are cheap for a reason. They've either been deficient in the past or have something wrong with them now. Stocks are like anything else. The best quality never comes at the cheapest price. That's not all. Low-priced stocks usually cost more in commissions and markups. And since they can drop 15% to 20% faster than most higher-priced issues, they also carry greater risk. Most professionals and institutions won't normally invest in $5 and $10 stocks, so they do not have a top-notch following. Penny stocks are even worse. As we discussed earlier, institutional sponsorship is one of the ingredients needed to help propel a stock higher in price. Cheap stocks also have larger spreads in terms of the percentage difference between the bid and ask price. Compare a $5 stock that trades $5 bid, five and a quarter ask, versus a $50 stock that trades $50 bid, 50 and a quarter ask. On your $5 stock, that quarter difference is almost 5% of the bid price. On your $50 stock, that quarter difference is a negligible 0.5%. The difference is a factor of 10. As a result, with low-priced stocks, you tend to have much more ground to make up from your initial buy point, just to break even and overcome the spread. 5. Wanting to make a quick and easy buck. Wanting too much too fast Without doing the necessary preparation, learning the soundest methods, or acquiring the essential skills and discipline, can be your downfall. Chances are you'll jump into a stock too fast, and then be too slow to cut your losses when you are wrong. 6. Buying on tips, rumors, split announcements, and other news events, stories, advisory service recommendations, or opinions you hear from supposed market experts on TV. In other words, many people are too willing to risk their hard-earned money on what someone else says, rather than taking the time to study, learn, and know for sure what they're doing. As a result, they risk losing a lot of money. Most rumors and tips you hear simply aren't true. Even if they are true, in most cases the stock concerned will ironically go down, not up. 7. Selecting second-rate stocks because of dividends or low price-earnings, P.E. ratios. Dividends and P.E. ratios aren't as important as earnings per share growth. In many cases, the more a company pays in dividends, the weaker it may be. It may have to pay high interest rates to replenish funds paid out in the form of dividends. Better-performing companies will typically not issue dividends. Instead, they reinvest their capital into research and development, R&D, or other corporate improvements. Also keep in mind that you can lose the amount of a dividend in 1 or 2 days' fluctuation in the price of the stock. As for P.E. ratios, a low P.E. is probably low because the company's past record is inferior. Most stocks sell for what they're worth at the time. 8. Never getting out of the starting gate properly due to poor selection criteria and not knowing exactly what to look for in a successful company. Many buy fourth-rate, nothing-to-write-home-about stocks that are not acting particularly well, have questionable earnings, sales growth, and return on equity, and are not the true market leaders. Others overly concentrate in highly speculative or lower-quality, risky technology securities. 9. Buying old names you're familiar with. Just because you used to work for General Motors doesn't necessarily make it a good stock to buy. Many of the best investments will be newer names that you won't know, but which, with a little research, you could discover and profit from before they become household names. 10. Not being able to recognize and follow good information and advice. Friends, relatives, certain stockbrokers and advisory services might all be sources of bad advice. Only a small minority are successful enough themselves to merit your consideration. Outstanding stockbrokers or advisory services are no more plentiful than outstanding doctors, lawyers, or ballplayers. Only 1 out of 9 baseball players who sign professional contracts ever make it to the big leagues. Most of the ballplayers that graduate college simply are not professional caliber. 11. Not using charts and being afraid to buy stocks that are going into new high ground in price. Over 98% of the masses will generally think that a stock making a new high price seems too high, but personal feelings and opinions are far less accurate than the market itself. The best time to buy a stock during a bull market is when the stock initially emerges from a price consolidation or sound basing area of at least 7 or 8 weeks. 12. Cashing in small, easy-to-take profits while holding the losers. In other words, doing exactly the opposite of what you should be doing, cutting losses short and giving your profits more time. 13. Worrying too much about taxes and commissions. The name of the game is to first make a net profit. Excessive worrying about taxes usually leads to unsound investment decisions in the hope of achieving a tax shelter. You can also fritter away a good profit by holding on too long, trying to get a long-term capital gain. Some investors convince themselves they can't sell because of taxes, but that's ego trumping judgment. The commissions associated with buying and selling stocks, especially through an online broker, are minor compared with the money to be made by making the right decisions in the first place and taking action when needed. The fact that you pay relatively low commissions and can get out of your investment much faster are two of your biggest advantages of owning stock over real estate. With instant liquidity, you can protect yourself quickly at low cost and take advantage of highly profitable new trends as they continually evolve. 14. Concentrating your time on what to buy, and once the buy decision is made, not understanding when or under what conditions the stock must be sold. Most investors have no rules or plan for selling stocks, doing only half of the homework necessary to succeed. 15. Failing to understand the importance of buying quality companies with good institutional sponsorship, and the importance of learning how to use charts to significantly improve selection and timing. 16. Speculating too heavily in options or futures, because they're thought to be a way to get rich quick. Some investors also focus mainly on shorter-term, lower-priced options that involve greater volatility and risk. The limited time period works against short-term option holders. Some also write naked options, selling options on stocks they do not even own, which amounts to taking great risk for a potentially small reward. 17. Rarely transacting at the market and preferring to put price limits on their buy and sell orders. By doing so, they're quibbling for eighths and quarters of a point, or their decimal equivalents, rather than focusing on the stock's larger and more important movement. With limit orders, you run the risk of missing the market completely and not getting out of stocks that should be sold to avoid substantial losses. 18. Not being able to make up your mind when a decision needs to be made. Many don't know if they should buy, sell, or hold, and the uncertainty shows that they have no guidelines. Most people don't follow a proven plan, a set of strict principles, or buy and sell rules to correctly guide them. 19. Not